College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Nagandi.
Well, the regular season is now in the books. We're in December. Ton of news with coaching changes, SEC quarterbacks transferring already. Why I wish this weekend was a quarterfinal playoff weekend. But let's get on the field with the topics. An eventful final weekend of the regular season, capping off in November. That really was a playoff for teams trying to position themselves for that final spot. We still have a few questions to answer at number four. Hopefully we'll get some clarity during championship week. Thawing out from his snow globe trip in Minnesota, as he does every Monday, Kirk Herbstreit joining us. Herbie, what was the scene like for you, first experience for game day in Minnesota and also watching Wisconsin-Minnesota?
Oh, it was great, man. It was, as you said, it was like a snow globe. We had some ice and freezing rain on Friday night, but, you got to give credit to their fan base. They were first time, as you said, we've ever been there, and they were elated to have a chance to shed, some light on their program and the entire nation to see the loyalty they have for that team. And they came up short clearly in the game. Wisconsin just dialed in, you know, so much talk about PJ Fleck and Minnesota, and man, don't forget, they control their own destiny. They can get to the Big Ten title, and if they win that game, they're still in the playoff. And somebody forgot to tell Paul Christ and the Badgers, because they came in and wanted that axe back that they lost a year ago in Madison at home. And to their credit, they took control of that game. But yeah, we had a great game day, unbelievable setting. I love it up there. Colder the better, the more snow the better. The game was, like you said, a snow globe. So the way it should be when they're battling for the axe in late November.
And you could tell what the axe meant to them in the end zone after the game, right?
Yeah.
You guys had some pictures. They were great with that snow as they were taking down obviously the imaginary field goal post right there.
Yeah.
Bringing it down. That was really cool.
Yeah, I think sometimes people maybe look at some of these trophies and roll their eyes and think, you know, what is this one? An axe, a pig, you know, this one, that one. But when you're in those programs, and you're 18 to 22 years old and you get caught up in the rivalry, you can kind of feel that even as an outsider, the meaning of that axe and what it meant to both teams. Minnesota hadn't seen it in whatever it was, 14 straight years. And then for them to take it away, right underneath the nose of Wisconsin at home, I don't think that sat real well with the Badgers, the returning seniors and juniors who were used to that thing, you know, being in Madison. And so they came back, and when they won that game, they sprinted to the end zone and got the axe. And then it looked like all the starters or all the seniors, or they just kind of passed it around and took different, hacks at the, as you said, the imaginary goalpost. And I think it was more symbolic of what they had accomplished. And it's kind of cool, man. It's another thing that I think makes college football what it is and how unique it can be. And I really enjoyed calling the game and had a great time watching the post-game celebration.
Now, game day is going to be in Atlanta, of course, getting ready for the SEC championship game, LSU versus Georgia. Some questions with that Bulldogs offense right now. We'll try to focus on that a little bit later on. But then Friday night, you and Fowler are going to be at the Pac-12 championship game in Santa Clara, right? With Utah facing Oregon.
Yeah.
Then you fly into Atlanta, and then you do game day. And then what's the game you guys are doing on Saturday?
I will not be doing a game. The one game we have is Friday night, the Pac-12 championship, where if Utah can get to the finish line. And then they'll, depending on if they can beat Oregon, they'll sit back and wait if they win that game to see if LSU can knock off Georgia, where they're favored by a touchdown. And if that happens, you know, and then we'll see what happens in the Big 12 championship. It becomes a debate there with Alabama losing. And we'll talk more about this here on this podcast, but a very good chance that Utah could be in the pole position there. We'll see what the rankings say on Tuesday night, but there's a lot at stake there, in Santa Clara for the Utes and even for the Ducks trying to get to a Pac-12 championship game after they stumbled a couple weeks ago in Tempe against Herm and the Sun Devils. But, it's setting itself up. Then I'll fly right after that game. I'll fly to Atlanta, try to get a few hours of sleep and then do college game day, from the SEC championship. And then, I'm going to, stay and actually have a chance to stand on the sideline and watch the game, which I'm really looking forward to. I haven't done that in a long time.
That's got to be really weird for you, right? On a Saturday where you can just watch a game. You're not worrying about calling a game later on.
It's cool. I mean, I used to do that every week. You know, when I first started on game day, the first, I don't know, 8 or 9 years, it was like you do game day and then you're at the game of the week and you stand on the sidelines and watch the game. I mean, that was, for me, man, that was awesome to do and saw so many great settings and games. And then when I started calling the game, the primetime game on ABC in 06, from that point on, I do game day and I either stay and call the game that night or I fly to another location. So I really do miss that aspect of my job because I feel like you can pick up so many nuances and so many different things that you can't always see when you're watching on TV. And, I'm very like dialed in when I'm on the sideline, watching coaches, watching how they communicate. Never forget my favorite game of all time doing this was when Cam Newton and Auburn was, they were playing Alabama the day after Thanksgiving. And Alabama got up huge, like 28-3 in Tuscaloosa. The game looks like it's over. And boy, I'm just sitting there on the Auburn sideline and I'm watching. I wanted to see how Cam Newton handled all the adversity and all the people taunting him because that was the year he sat out a game or two because he was alleged to have taken money and the NCAA was investigating and he came back to play in that game and people were just giving him all kinds of the business about, you know, off the field stuff. And here he is down 28-3 and supposed to be a year where he could maybe win a Heisman and lo and behold, they caught a break, caught a fumble, went through the end zone of Auburn's and they got the ball back, put a touchdown up. And I'm just sitting like 10 feet away from Cam Newton the whole time watching him going down from 28-3, slowly climbing back and watching him just every possession, they'd get a little closer and a little closer and his energy and his eyes and the way they were focused on his teammates is something I'll never forget. It was a very cool experience, but that was one. But I love, the opportunity to be down there and just kind of take it all in.
Auburn fans will never forget that game. And it's a perfect segue to Auburn fans not forgetting this Iron Bowl this weekend. And all the credit goes to the Tigers, Gus, that defense, Bo Nix, that crowd, the environment of Jordan-Hare was fantastic. And Zakobe McClain with the 100-yard pick six, a play I've never seen before, the way it played out. And then Alabama with the injuries through the season taking its toll for the team at quarterback, on defense, the 13 penalties, and of course that one late in the fourth quarter with the illegal substitution as Gus went deep into that playbook, pulled out a formation he's been sitting on for years, and Nick afterwards not pleased by it. You guys were obviously on that Minnesota broadcast, but you had at least a chance to watch the fourth quarter, right?
I was watching the whole game.
You watch it, right?
Yeah, I had, of course, I'm calling our game, and then I've got Auburn and Alabama in our monitor. And again, you and I have talked about this in the past, you know, the ability to try to call the game and watch another game at the same time. As I've said, I have very few talents, but that happens to be one of them. So I was watching along and just amazed with the way Mac Jones was playing in that game. And, you know, he's facing that defense and continue to come up with some answers. I know he had a couple pick sixes, but I just want to say this about Auburn before we get too far into that game. I called their first game of the year against Oregon, and they played the true freshman Bo Nix, and they came up with a win late where Oregon controlled much of that game, but give credit to Auburn for coming up with that throw to Seth Williams late and the freshman. And they went on to win, I think, their first 4 or 5 games. They're all the way up to, I think, 7th in the country, and then they had to go to Gainesville. And that was another College Game Day show and taking on Florida and Dan Mullen. And, you know, they found a new quarterback and they were humming. And it was tough, I think, for the young quarterback to go into that atmosphere. And they came up a little bit short. And a couple weeks later, same deal, going in to take on Joe Burrow and LSU. They came up a little bit short in that game, had to play Georgia. I mean, think about the run that they've had, not only the SEC West. But they get Oregon in a non-conference game. They draw, of course, Georgia every year and Florida in the SEC East and really get challenged. And it came up a little bit short against Georgia. All these games very competitive. And then they go into the Iron Bowl. And, you know, I don't want to make excuses for Alabama with the injuries on defense because Auburn has never lost to to Alabama, Jordan Hare, when they've been ranked. And I think last Saturday was a good reminder of why it's hard to beat Auburn when they are a good team, against Alabama. And, you know, Gus Malzahn with the play there at the end that caught Alabama and Nick Saban off guard where they had 12 men on the field. Just a great call, very aggressive move. I think eventually they would have called a timeout and punted the ball, but they took a chance and I think they confused, Alabama's special teams unit. And just the way Auburn played the entire game was impressive. And, for the journey, the gauntlet that they went through to finish 9-3 with Bo Nix. If I'm an Auburn fan, I'm really excited about Bo Nix and the future. I know they lose some great defensive players, but that was a heck of a run this year, even though they finished the year 9-3.
And I know, you know, the easy thing is to blame the kicker. Get out of town here. There were so many things that were going on. You should make a 30-yarder, and the young man apologized, and he's going through it worse than anybody else. But to me, there are a lot of things here. The backstory with the credit goes to Auburn, but also the 13 penalties. That's really uncharacteristic of a Nick Saban team. And then this, the craziest stat, and we've heard it, you know, in the last 48 hours since Saban took over, you know, at Alabama in 2007, no team in the country has missed more field goals. It's just a crazy thing where you can control the entire environment, but you can't control the kick.
Yeah.
And it, to me, it's just how many people
raised their hand, including you and I, when the kicker came out, because it's Alabama and kicks don't always go their way, thought, oh no. I know I did. And he's a very competent kicker, but I just thought, oh gosh, this is scary. You know, I even said to Fowler, he's going to hook this left. I thought it might be wide, like just a shank, but it came close, just hit the upright, but it just had one of those eerie feelings like it's not going to work out for Alabama. And we're talking a lot about Bo Nix and a lot of, you know, about the kick, but Mac Jones against that defense, kid has never started a game on the road. The pressure, how's he going to do? How are they going to do without Tua? People have been ripping on him before the game. He's not any good. He can't do it. And well, I don't know why, first of all, why people would do that. Kid's never played. I mean, you're going to say he's not any good. He's never really played. He played against Western Carolina. He's done some mop-up duty. This is his first game. And I for one, wanted to see Mac Jones. See, I'd seen him in the spring game. I've seen him in practice. I've always walked away like, kid's pretty good. Now he's been behind Jalen Hurts and Tua. Who wouldn't be behind those two?
Exactly.
So he gets his chance in a game against Derrick Brown and Marlon Davidson and Kevin Steele in that defense. And Sark puts him in a position. He goes 26-39. Now I know he had the two pick sixes. I get it. But overall, 335 yards through the air, four touchdown passes. He'd love, I'm sure, to have those pick sixes back. But for considering he's never started a game in that atmosphere on the road in a rivalry game, I think the kid deserves a lot of credit. I thought they had a really good attack. I mean, Najee Harris went for 146. You know, they had a very balanced attack. So I hate people that make excuses. I hate people that rip on these players. They had 515 yards of total offense. And, you know, that's not bad. Last time I checked, it just, end of the day, it came down to some missed field goals and the two pick sixes. I mean, that's going to cost you.
We're watching the game. Obviously we have all the monitors. We always talk about this, but like at one point I turned to JV, Jonathan Velma, and Mark Sanchez, and I'm like, Jalen Waddle is shredding Auburn's defense because of the speed. And he's the fourth guy when you look at the depth chart at wide receiver because this group is so stacked. And at one point I said, this may be the most talented wide receiver group we've ever seen. And that's saying a heck of a lot, especially in today's game when you look at all the wide receivers at USC, LSU, and Clemson right now. And that's good Alabama's depth is right now.
You know, I think
it's crazy.
It is. You're right. And I think most of the year, you know, Ruggs, Smith, Judy, they got all the attention. And Waddle, because of his role within that offense, you know, a lot of times he's put in the slot. He's more of a get the ball in space kind of guy. And just the way their offense worked out, a lot of times play action or run pass option, You know, Devontae Smith would hit a quick slant and it'd be yards after the catch. Ruggs would get a deep ball. It wasn't that they weren't trying to get Waddle the ball, but everybody knew what he was capable of doing after seeing him last year. But man, he's one of those guys. He gets a football, whether it's a kick return, a bubble screen, anywhere at all, he's got a chance to make the first guy miss. And if you don't have leverage, if you don't have a second and third defender trying to take care of him, he's just one of those. You could put him right up there at the beginning of the year with Rondale Moore, KJ Hamler, mm-hmm. as far as guys that in space are going to embarrass you. And he got a chance to finally do that late in the year and, of course, had a monster game against Auburn. But, again, all the credit to Gus Malzahn, Auburn, just a gauntlet of a season to finish 9-3 in an era where all we hear about is, are they in the four? Is it all about the playoff, playoff, playoff? I love to celebrate teams like Auburn who went 9-3 and they're ready to fire Gus Malzahn after they lose to Georgia. They're ready to fire Gus Malzahn after they lose. He's not the guy. What's he doing? And now they want to give him a raise after he beats Alabama. I mean, imagine living in that world as a head coach where, and every fan base, but not as loud and as real as Auburn. And he just kind of blocks it all out, keeps coaching, keeps believing in his kids, keeps his kids fighting, keeps them just kind of chopping wood, despite some setbacks, and still has them in the mindset to be able to win the Iron Bowl. I think his fan base should be celebrating Gus Malzahn and being very thankful that he's their head coach.
And I say this with all the love in the world, because I actually love passionate fan bases, but I love the Auburn thing, and that is, after you lose the Georgia and LSU, fire Gus. After you beat Bama, give him an extension.
Oh, yeah.
That just sums up everything on the Plains, right? And how they view this relationship with Gus through the years.
Oh, absolutely. I think this goes way back, though. I think it's almost any coach who's been there knows that that's kind of part of the deal. I mean, as great as they are celebrating him right now, God forbid he doesn't have his team ready to play in a bowl game and they're kind of celebrating that big win in the Iron Bowl and they show up, you know, stuck in third gear, not ready to, you know, they kind of reminded me of that emotionally when they played UCF a few years ago, came up a little short in getting into the playoff and they went down, I think it was the Sugar Bowl, I believe it was the Sugar Bowl, and they just, I'm not taking anything away from UCF, but that was not the Auburn team we had seen most of the year emotionally. And they got embarrassed by UCF. Maybe they'll use that as a motivator. They sure did last year when they played Purdue in their bowl game in Nashville in the Music City Bowl. So maybe they'll use that again to make sure, because, you know, he knows better than anybody. You're only as good as your last victory when you're the head coach at Auburn.
And Gus can say he joins Les Miles, the only coaches to beat Nick Saban three times. Think about that. And you know, Bear put out a stat, which was incredible, after the game. In its bowl game, Alabama will play its 167th game since the start of 2008. It'll be just the seventh time the Tide take the field without a chance of winning the national championship.
Wow.
That's just absolutely incredible. It just shows you how Nick Saban can adjust over a decade. And with the turnover rate of all the coaches and the assistants through the years, especially this year.
Well, last 2 years, I think he's lost, he lost like six and then he lost seven, you know, losing coordinators. And I think it finally caught up to him, to be candid. I think it's one thing we could talk about the injuries. We could talk about the inexperience. I will not be surprised if there's some shakeup on that staff. I don't know who, I don't know how he'll do it, but I just feel like defensively they're not the same bully that they used to be. And I think he wants to get back to being that. I think that'll be a big part and a big emphasis, you know, of who they want to be. And I think we've all focused on, I mean, Alabama's not a team that wants to have to get into games where they want to outscore people. You know, that's not, and we appreciate Tua, we appreciate the offense, but I don't think they want to play in games like LSU. You know, LSU, Joe Burrow, it seems like every time he has the ball, they're scoring. And Tua and those receivers, they're just trying to stay up with Joe Burrow. That is not Alabama football. And the same thing against Auburn. You know, here they are. It ends up 48-45 and they're throughout the game. I forget the score at halftime, but you're looking at that score at halftime. You're like, what? That's Alabama Auburn. So I know we live in an era of spread, but we lived in an era in spread about 3 or 4 years ago and they were giving up about 13 a game. So I don't know what he's going to do with recruiting, staff changes. I don't think he's sleeping well at night, not just because he lost to Auburn, but because of the way his defense played against LSU and Auburn. The two teams that really had a chance to challenge them, just put on an offensive clinic. LSU scores 46, Auburn scores 48. That to me is the most alarming thing. And that's where I think you're going to see, some changes. I have no idea. I don't have any inside information on what that means. I just know that I know Nick Saban very well, and I know that he's probably looking at that film over and over and over again saying, we got to get better, and we got to figure out some answers right now. So we'll see what he does.
We'll be back in a minute with Herbie as we dive into Ohio State and their dominating performance over Michigan. We've been saying it for weeks, but Saturday confirmed it. This is the best Ohio State team in ages. And what does Michigan have to do to get past the Buckeyes going forward? We're going to get into all of that. But first, a word from AT&T. Yeah, college football is great unless, of course, it's just okay. Like when students decide to paint their chest with different letters to spell some word and then they stand together to get on TV, but they're spelling the word wrong or they lined up in the wrong order. Sure, not everybody's an English major, and I get it. We can't all win the national spelling bee. But come on, people. You should know how to spell Wildcats or Bulldogs. The purpose isn't to have a word jumble in the student section to keep your mind sharp or something. Just okay is not okay, whether it's college football fans or your wireless network. You want to watch the best college football just like you want to go with AT&T, America's best network. Don't settle for typos on people's chests and don't settle for anything less than the best wireless network. Get the best college football and get AT&T. Best network based on GWS One Score, September 2019.
You know who's asking those same questions right now, and I'm not sure if he has any of those answers, is Jim Harbaugh. And as we transition to the Big Ten and what we saw in Ann Arbor, Ohio State has now won 8 straight games against their big rival. But this one felt different, especially in that first half with Jay Patterson. He played really well in that first half. It felt different because Ryan Day, for the second straight year, and this game plan scoring over 50 points against Don Brown's defense. Just when you look at Ohio State and Michigan, you know there are stars on both sides. It just feels like Ohio State stars are just a step above better in every single way. And that is Justin Fields, J.K. Dobbins, Olave. Chris Young, Chase Young didn't have a big game, but still you found a way that his presence was felt. Is this the best Ohio State team? We've talked about this a couple times, yeah. But after that performance, is this the best Ohio State team you have seen so far?
Well, we've talked all year, as you just said, about potentially this being one of the best teams in the country and the best team in the country because of the consistency on offense and defense. Last year, Ohio State had Dwayne Haskins, and it was a record-breaking year for the passing game with Ryan Day and Haskins and those receivers. But they also had moments defensively where you would watch them and think, boy, what is going on? You know, and it wasn't just the Purdue game. It was a lot of other games. And Ryan Day takes over and he makes a lot of changes, brings in Jeff Hafley, Greg Madison over from Michigan. And I think most people that have watched Ohio State closely, yeah, Justin Fields and J.K. Dobbins, it's a different offensive approach, more balanced, more threatening because of the quarterback run threat. But I think the defense, man, the improvement on that side of the ball has been the thing that has really stood out all year. So they go into a rivalry game, and once again, it's all hands on deck. Harbaugh, Don Brown had the quote a couple weeks ago. You know, they better be ready. Yeah, we've been practicing too. You know, all these things that were coming out of Ann Arbor and Ohio State in their backyard right in Ann Arbor. What are they going to do? How are they going to handle Michigan? Takes the opening drive. They go down and score. Harbaugh's on the sideline going crazy. And I think Michigan was thinking, finally, this is going to be the year. And Ryan Day deserves a lot of credit for the way his team handled that. They responded. They didn't get too high. They didn't get down. It was just the same team they have been all year, which to me goes back to preparation, not getting emotional, not getting too high, not getting too down. There's no roller coaster at all with this Ohio State team. It's almost like the great Alabama teams over the years. It's like a business trip. It's just lock in, do my job, move on. What's the next assignment? Here we go. Here it is. Boom. And it's just, it's really fun to watch teams that are able to do that as consistently, as they've been able to do it. So I bumped in, just a quick story. I bumped into Barry Alvarez, the athletic director at Wisconsin, at halftime. He stopped by the booth, said hello to Chris and I, and we were just talking about a bunch of things in that 20-minute span. And one of the things we talked about was, man, I said, man, how about the Buckeyes? You know, that was incredible today. He goes, boy, that Ryan Day and Ohio State. He goes, I'm going to tell you something. He goes, as a coach and an AD, I've been in the Big Ten since, I think, 1990 or 91. He said, it's the best Big Ten team I've seen. And he's like, wow. Not even, no question. And think about, there have been some pretty darn good Big Ten teams since 1990 that have come through. And he just, without hesitation, said, this is the most complete team. And, you know, it's one thing for you and I and others to say that, but for a guy who's coached and been an AD and seen them all, to say that, I think that kind of puts in perspective who this team has been. And I don't know if enough credit is being given to Ryan Day. I'm just so impressed with him as a coach, with his team, with his way his offense is ready to play, with the way his defense, the emotions of their team. You know, they don't seem to be brash. They're not really taunting, getting over top of people. There have been a couple examples, but it's just, I think, filling the shoes of Urban Meyer and being himself. That's tough to do. You think about filling the shoes of a living legend who still is stopping by the practices and still around the building, and yet he's able to go do it his way. I think it says a lot about him. And to feel the pressure of, hey, he's 0-0 against Michigan. Jim Harbaugh kind of backed into a corner in a must-win situation. And Jim Harbaugh did everything that he possibly could do, and they lose 56-27. And Ohio State in that second half just pulled away. And Michigan, you know, they started to drop balls. They just, yeah, it reminded me a lot of the Michigan-Wisconsin game where Michigan kind of shut down their operation. Just did not look like the same team in that second half. Once the game felt like it was out of reach, they didn't look like the Michigan team in the first half at all. And so I think Ohio State killed their will, and the beat goes on for Ohio State, the athletic ability, the physicality at the line of scrimmage, just complete domination. And I don't know if this rivalry has seen the likes of this maybe ever. If you go back to when Jim Tressel was there all the way through to this past Saturday, I mean, Ohio State is just complete domination.
Herbie, what do you make of Michigan's conundrum? Because let's just play this out a little bit. It's not as simple as Harbaugh now is 0-5, the first coach to lose his first five games in this rivalry. You could play another scenario out and say, well, if they go to a bowl game that where they're successful and they win, it's another 10-win season. It is the most misleading or weird 10-3 season. A couple to from last year and what they went and what they experienced. Like, what do you make of what Michigan is in? Because it's easy to say, get Harbaugh out. Let's stop doing that without saying, well, who should come in? How do you turn this around? What do you make of where this program is right now with Jim Harbaugh?
Well, when you lose the way that you're losing five straight to Ohio State, it can take the soul of the program out. And I think the challenge for Jim and for that program is to put that rivalry and to put that in its proper perspective instead of shaking it off and, hey, we got to get better. Got to coach better. We got to recruit better. I think it's not that. It's so much deeper than that. And, you know, I keep hearing comments from Ohio State players and coaches about, you know, this rivalry means everything to us. Like it doesn't mean something to us this week. Like, we don't just have this clock running down so the fans can, oh, look, there's a clock over there. Like, they live it. They do reps in the weight room in February about it. Like it's around every room at Ohio State. And it's not just for recruiting and it's not just to just have it. Like it's embedded in who they are, right? That game. And to their credit, they've made it that way and their kids have accepted it. Michigan, I think, has tried to, they've tried a lot of different things. And John Cooper went through this, you know, and John Cooper at one point said, hey, we're going to approach it like it's just any other game, you know, and then he had moments where it's like, it's everything. It's everything. So, I mean, they tried anything they could and John Cooper never quite could kind of shake that. And I think he ended up like 2-10-1 or something like that, against Michigan. And I think Jim Harbaugh now is facing the same thing. The idea of firing him is ridiculous. Who are you going to bring in that has a better feel for what Michigan is about? But I think Jim Harbaugh has to be willing to change who he is. I think he tried that with his offense over the last couple of years, bringing in Shea Patterson, trying to get more spread, trying to kind of catch up with the way everybody's running offenses today. Josh Gattis, of course, you know, and I don't know if their offense is a problem. I mean, Shea Patterson, those receivers, I mean, they're pretty darn good. I think the issue is, clearly, you know, the defense with Don Brown has done such a good job, you know, in most games that they've played. I mean, they're shutting people down. They get into that Ohio State game and the Buckeyes have a plan and they're just one step ahead. And to be honest, I mean, if you don't have J.K. Dobbins and you don't have Justin Fields and you don't have some of the receivers, Olave, that they have and some of the guys, K.J. Hill, Ryan Day's not a magician. They recruit really good players. Mm-hmm. You know, if you just have a guy in that backfield, those 25-yard gains are 5-yard gains. J.K. Dobbins is a freak of nature. He's a human muscle, like a bowling ball that's twitchy. Like, I don't know how you tackle him, right? And then other than untying his shoe and trying to take it off, like, what do you do when he's got a little bit of space and he can run over top of you and he can shake you and go around you? I mean, he's elite. Those Michigan running backs are good, but they're not hold your breath. Oh my gosh. Kind of guys. Right. And you got to recruit those guys. You got to find players that make the same plays better. And right now, Ohio State, it's not just that they're out coaching them and it's not just that. It's they're out recruiting them. They have different level athletes and they have different level linemen. And it's just they're a notch or two above where Michigan is. And the only answer I have is you can change your scheme all you want. You got to go out and recruit. You got to recruit at a whole different level. And use Ohio State as kind of the barometer. That's where we're going. And in the SEC, everybody looks at Alabama. I don't care if it's LSU. I don't care if it's Auburn, Texas A&M. Everybody looks to recruit. We have to match up with those guys. We have to be able to recruit at that level. And if you can't do that, you're not going to beat them. And I think if I'm Jim Harbaugh, I'm challenging my staff and I'm looking at that film. Where's a J.K. Dobbins that we can go find? We got to recruit a guy like that. We got to recruit a defensive lineman like that. We got to recruit linebackers and safeties and corners. We got to go find these guys, you know, and, you know, I would not give up on Jim Harbaugh, even though it's the easy answer in today's world. A guy lose a game, five, let alone five rivalry games, fire him. You want to start all over? And who are you going to bring in? Who's this?
That's been the question, right?
Who in the world are they going to bring in that's going to like fix everything? Rich Rod tried that. Brady Hoke tried that. I mean, this has been going on for a while. This has been 08 is when things started to really go sideways. Ohio State's been beating Michigan since going back to when Tressel came there in 01. I mean, think about how long that is. I think they've lost two or three, maybe, you know, the year that Luke Fickell stepped in as an interim. I mean, Jim Tressel was 8-1 against Michigan. Urban Meyer was 7-0 against Michigan. And we're almost talking two decades now.
Yeah.
So it's not just Jim Harbaugh. This is an Ohio State-Michigan thing, and it's a talent gap from one school to the other.
And the thing for Michigan fans too have to be wondering, because last year you looked at their defense. Now, granted, there were some guys that sat out and some injuries and stuff, but they felt like this was the team, right? That was the team in Columbus that was going to win and close out Urban Meyer's career. And then they fell flat because their defense was stunned. And then entering this season, there was the preseason hype where this is now the Michigan offense. This is now the team, right? When you look at the preseason rankings, and it's Ryan Day's first year, Urban's gone. This is now the time for the Wolverines. So it has to be heartbreak for them where they're like, oh no, this is the same record we keep on seeing now for nearly two decades.
And the last thing I would say about this, like just observing and watching, I think that there is a mental toughness to Ohio State that I think if you really watch football, you really appreciate. And that comes from their strength and conditioning program. Coach Mick is, if not the top, he's right there. And again, that goes back to, okay, the bowl game ends in January, right? Whatever game you end up playing, and maybe it's a national championship, but whatever it is, the 13th, right? Give them a week off, and now all of a sudden go to work on January 20th. And no one's around. There's nobody reporting anything on any of these teams. That's where you win Ohio State Michigan game. What are you doing on January 20th? What are you doing in February when it's dark, it's cold, snow on the ground? Are you just going through your workouts? You know, you're looking in the mirror, you're flexing. Like, what are you doing? All these teams, January and February and March and April and May and June and July, those months when only guy that's around is the strength coach and his staff, and he's working on the minds as much as he's working on how much do you bench, how much do you squat, how much do you deadlift, what's your 40 time, all that stuff's great. It's the mindset that he is establishing. And I think Ohio State, they're as mentally tough as any team that you watch in college football. And I think that's undervalued because you can't really gauge that. You can't measure that other than by the way they play. And I'm so impressed over the years with Ohio State's mental toughness. And I think that's an area when you put those two teams on the same field, I think Ohio State blows Michigan out when it comes to the mental toughness. It's one thing to take the field and have a lot of bravado and chirp and get excited and all that. It's another thing just to play for 60 minutes, foot on accelerator, not letting up. And no matter what happens, good things happen, we don't care. Bad things happen, we don't care. It's a mindset. And right now they're right at the top as far as setting the bar for the mindset of a team.
Up next for the Buckeyes, the Big Ten Championship, which is a rematch against Wisconsin where they dominated. And that was the Chase Young game where I think anybody that follows college football knew about Chase Young, but it's the national attention that he drew because he was in the backfield that entire game. We'll see how that plays out. That is one championship game. Another one is the ACC on Saturday night, and it features Clemson up against Bryce Perkins in Virginia. A great game on Friday between Virginia and Virginia Tech, and their reward, the Cavaliers, as they beat Virginia Tech for the first time in 15 games after 15 losses, is Clemson. And a different mindset here. The big conversation is Dabo's rant after beating South Carolina, talking about keeping – I'm not sure who he's talking about, but he said that there's somebody wants to keep Clemson out of the playoff. When we find out who that person is or that group, we'll make sure that we give them the business. But he was making sure that he sent a message. This is a team that won 27 straight games. It's the longest active winning streak in the FBS. What's behind the messaging here when he makes this comparison that Georgia loses to South Carolina and they want to keep Georgia in? We, you know, do what we do against South Carolina and they want to keep us out. There was obviously some psychological stuff here for his team. What was the messaging in your mind with Dabo going off after that game?
I think he's just continuing to look for an edge, continuing as his team continues to dominate. He's just finding anything and everything he can to try to push buttons on his team. He's anything that I think, he says to the media, he's saying, defending his program and taking something, and trying to make sure his players know people don't respect you. I don't care what you've done. They don't care. You're not good in their mind. You're not good enough. You're not Alabama. You're not Ohio State. You're not LSU. You're not those teams. Like, he's doing anything he can. Now, the world on the outside looks at that and thinks, what? What's he talking about? But go back to when Clemson lost. There was a lot of dialogue, or not lost, when they felt like they lost. There was a lot of dialogue around, boy, they could have lost to North Carolina. Man, they're not as good as they were last year. And Trevor Lawrence is throwing all these picks. Man, Trevor's not as good as he was last year. There was a lot of talk about that. Now, that was five, six weeks ago, you know, when that talk was out there. Since then, you know, I think we've seen everything settle down. Clemson, for the last, you know, I don't know how many weeks now, 7, 8 weeks, they're blowing people out. You know, they came back that next week against Florida State and blew them out, blew Louisville out, blew Boston College out, NC State, Wake. I mean, they've been beating people. It's an embarrassment what they're doing to people. And I think even then, that's the ACC. They're terrible. So that's, I think he hears some of that. And, you know, he grew up an underdog. It's just, it's his mindset. They could win 5 straight national championships and Dabo is going to find a way to be an underdog. It's, you know, I don't think you can reason with it. I don't think you can sit there and logically break down. Okay. Well, this makes sense. I think he's just looking to have a chip on his shoulder, try to create a chip on his team's shoulder. And by the way, it's working. You know, his team is showing up in a bad mood and just dominating people. Look, you know how many points they've given up? I mean, and who knows? I feel like we're going to find out how good Clemson is when they play in the playoff. Like right now we think they're great and they look great. I mean, look, since the North Carolina game, they beat Florida State 45-14. They beat Louisville 45-10. Boston College, 59-7. NC State, 55-10. Wake, here comes Wake. They're ready this year, 52-3. South Carolina, 38-3. I mean, and all these scores could be a lot worse. That's the scary thing. I mean, it could probably be in the 80s. And these 7s and these 14s that I'm reading could probably be 3 or 6. They've scored on the backup. So this team is as dominant as Ohio State. They're as dominant as anybody out there. It's just, I think they haven't played anybody. And so a lot of people look, they played A&M early, beat them 24-10. Who else have they played that's a team that you would say Louisville maybe? You know, that's a good team. Virginia this week, you know, will be a decent team that they'll play in the ACC championship. They're 9-3 and had a great year with Bronco Mendenhall beating Virginia Tech to advance. But I think when I hear him go off like that, I feel like he's sending a message. He's trying to keep that edge, trying to let this team play with a chip on their shoulder. And I think it's working, you know, and I think he'll do that. He'll do that on Sunday when we announce the teams. Poor old little Clemson. We're just the Roy bus and we're just happy they let us stumble into the tournament. We'll just do our best and we'll see what happens. And they're going to give us our jerseys and we're going to show up at the game. Even though nobody wants us to be there, we'll stumble into that stadium and little old Clemson's going to go out there and play in a game. I guess they're going to let us show up like that. He's going to do that all the way to kickoff. And if they win that one, same deal up going to the national championship. We just appreciate the chance to play. I'm surprised we're here after listening to all you boys. I'm surprised we're here in this championship. I'm telling you, he's going to say that all the way to the finish line. It's just who he is. It's the way it's again, he grew up an underdog and he loves to coach as an underdog.
And all the questions about Trevor Lawrence and what's wrong with him. I mean, the first 7 games, in 5 of them, he threw 8 picks, but keep this in mind, the last 5 games, he's thrown 16 touchdowns and no picks.
Wow.
He just looks like a different quarterback at the second half of the season, and he's peaking at the right time in this offense. It's a question. We haven't seen this team play four quarters because they don't have to play four quarters, right?
Right, right. I'll just say this. Just being around this game for a long time, there have been players in the past that have had monster freshman years, mm-hmm. and they come back their sophomore year, and there's so much media buzz and hype that everybody wanted to see Trevor Lawrence and the Trevor Lawrence against Alabama. Like, that was the bar. And I think he felt that noise. He's a human being. As good as he is, he's a human being who's only 19 years old or whatever he is. And so I think if he's guilty of anything, it's trying to make plays, trying to live up to that hype. And we've seen a lot of quarterbacks over the years go through that, learn some valuable lessons about, you know what, I'm going to just go back to just being me. I'm going to read the coverage. I'm going to distribute the ball, and that's it. And if it's not good enough, oh well. But I think you have to go through that, and it's part of your maturation. It's part of your experience as a quarterback. And I think he would be the first one to tell you that he felt some of that, and he felt a little need to press and try to live up to it. And he went through it for, like you said, four or five games. And I don't know if he had a conversation with himself or the coaches or looked at the film and saw a few bozo decisions and thought, man, what am I doing? Why am I trying to make plays? Let's go back to just plan. Let's go back to executing. And he's done that. And I think you have to experience it in order to realize you don't want to do that. And it's one thing to be told, hey, don't worry about it. But I think a lot of times you have to throw those picks. You have to go through some challenging times. And Trevor's done that, and he's been able to get through the other side of it. And right now with Travis Etienne behind him and Justin Ross and T. Higgins and Amari Rodgers and company on the outside, they're going to be tough for anybody that they match up with. And old Brent Venables, he's got a defense that's angry and tenacious. I can't wait to watch him. Once they get – they play their game against Virginia. It's going to be, I don't know who they're going to match up with, but I cannot wait to see them in a playoff.
No, seeding will play a huge role here, especially when we see LSU up against Georgia and of course Ohio State against Wisconsin on who gets that one seed, tries to face off against that fourth seed, because that's the biggest question that remains.
Yeah.
It's now time for the All-State Playoff Predictor segment with Herb Street here. Let's see where he thinks mayhem could strike this upcoming weekend. And remember, get better protection for mayhem with All-State. And Herbie, taking a look at the predictor following week 13 as we head into the championship weekend. No surprises here with Ohio State, LSU, and Clemson. All virtual locks for the playoff. After that, the predictor thinks it's going to come down to Georgia, 53% chance to make it, Oklahoma with a 37% chance to make it, and the playoff predictor is hugely disrespecting Utah and Baylor, giving them 9 and 8% chances to make the cut. So what do you think here, Kirk? Where's mayhem striking this week and upending these predictions?
Man, this is fun. I love the All-State playoff predictor because, as we've done all year, it's a chance for me to look ahead to the upcoming week and try to find where mayhem could change the game. And you just went through the list of some of the teams and the matchups, and this is the whole weekend is mayhem, right? I mean, for starting Friday night, meaningful game with Utah. And I know it seems like a lot of people are going, well, Utah, they're playing Oregon. That's an easy win. Ooh, be careful. Be careful with that game. And there's so much at stake, not just for Utah, but if Oregon were to upset Utah, I really think that could affect the Big 12 championship game, not just with Oklahoma, but if Baylor were to upset Oklahoma, if Oregon were to upset Utah, I think there's a very good chance that Matt Rhule could be the last team standing if LSU beats Georgia. You believe that Baylor? We could be talking about Baylor sitting there at the fourth seed. Not a lot of people talking about that, right? Everyone's talking about Oklahoma or Utah or maybe Georgia upsets LSU. You know, we're a couple upsets away from Baylor being the team, to get into that fourth and final spot. So, like I said, I think there's potentially mayhem across the board this weekend, and have a good time watching these games. Remember, Mayhem, he could show up on your turf, so get better protected with Allstate.
And we'll be back in a minute, but first, a word from Allstate.
Because mayhem on Saturdays in the fall is inevitable. Mayhem happens on the field, off the field, and in the polls. Mayhem lives on the wind, in the rain, on the foot of an errant kick, and during a trap game. You'll find mayhem in the parking lot, during tailgates, charcoal that's not totally out, an errant football through a window, a flat tire, a lost side view mirror, etc. You get the point. Allstate protects you from mayhem in the parking lot and outside it, at home and away. You can't stop mayhem from happening, but you can get better protected from it with Allstate. The potential for mayhem during the playoff race is rampant. Underdogs, trap games, unexpected weather, etc., etc., etc. Get better protected from mayhem with Allstate. Contact your local Allstate agent today.
All right, so Herbie, the big question, of course, we're taping this on Monday, and we'll find out what the committee thinks Tuesday night. To me, you brought up the Baylor scenario, and it's twofold with Matt Rhule and Baylor. Not so much where they were 2 years ago. That's crazy to think that it's a one-win team now in this conversation. It's what we've seen the last couple of weeks from this committee, right? Going from 14-9 to now potentially in a conversation where this week they're going to be, I would imagine, somewhere in the top 6-7 and then maybe making that leap. And that goes a little bit outside that playoff predictor here. When we look at all the scenarios and Baylor's opportunities, Oklahoma's opportunities and Utah's opportunities for that fourth spot.
But this is fun. This is what you hope for, right? You get to that final weekend and you think you have an idea of what might happen. Let's start with the easiest thing that could happen. To make it easy as far as the four. If Georgia beats LSU, then Georgia clearly is going to stay in the top four. If we assume that Clemson beats Virginia and Ohio State beats Wisconsin, I think it brings up the point of Ohio State would more than likely be at one if LSU loses to Georgia. Clemson probably goes to two. Maybe Georgia moves to two. I don't know, but it would be 2-3, I think, with Georgia and Clemson. And then you have LSU going from, depending on what happens Tuesday night, either 1 or 2 to 4. They're not going out if they lose to Georgia, unless they get completely bombed, which you can't imagine happening. And then maybe it's even a discussion. But I don't think LSU is taking the field with a loss and being eliminated. So I think – if that happens, Georgia is going to stay in the four. All four teams stay. I just think they change where the order of the four. So that closes the door on what about Oklahoma? What about Utah? That scenario is gone if Georgia wins. It's very simple. Mm-hmm. If LSU, if all the favorites, if Vegas is right and all the favorites win, Ohio State and LSU and Clemson, that would eliminate Georgia. Alabama's already gone after losing last week. And then it becomes, what does Utah do and what does Oklahoma do? If Utah wins on Friday night, I feel like there's a consensus in the social media world that almost feels like Utah has a back seat to Oklahoma. I don't know if people have been watching the rankings from the playoff committee, but the playoff committee has liked Utah more than Oklahoma every time they've released their rankings. And so, you know, I guess they're assuming that the committee would be more impressed with Oklahoma beating Baylor than they would be with Utah beating Oregon. Now, this is not just a last weekend, what did you do for the committee? This is week one to the last week. And how you've been trending, the direction the program is heading as you come into the final week. And then, of course, the final week is part of that, but not the all, you know, it's not the end of the entire discussion. So I don't know why. I think right now the playoff predictor has Utah. What was that percentage? It was very, very low.
Like, yeah, it was low. The Utah Baylor conversation is 9% and 8%.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm surprised by that because I really feel now I've watched Utah all year. just like I watch Oregon. I watch, like you, you watch these teams on the West Coast. I don't know what's to not like about Utah. You know, I think they've been a lot more consistent than what I've seen from Oklahoma down the stretch. I mean, if you go back and look at the way, and Oklahoma's a great team. Don't get me wrong. But I mean, if you go back to Oklahoma when they lost to Kansas State, and you know, that was not a great game for them on the road, lost in somewhat of a shootout. Their next game against Iowa State, they won by a point and very easily could have lost that game. They're down by 25 the next week to Baylor and the biggest comeback in school history to come back and beat Baylor. Then they go against TCU and they, another late interception by Jalen Hurts, and TCU has a chance to beat them. I mean, you're talking four straight weeks of games that came down to the final minute or so. And then they take care of business in Bedlam against Oklahoma State. So my point is, why is it just an assumption that Oklahoma is a superior team to Utah while Utah has been going out with the arguably the best defense in the country, definitely the best defense out west. And look what they've done in recent weeks since they lost to USC. They beat Washington State 38-13, Oregon State 52-7, Arizona State 21-3, Cal 35-0. They had a good challenge against Washington, a good team in Seattle, beat them 33-28. And they played UCLA 49-3. These sound like old Alabama scores, or current Clemson scores. Arizona 35-7, Colorado 45-15. I mean, they're blowing people out. And I don't know why it's, well, there's Oklahoma and, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. If they lose, there's Utah. I disagree. I think it's Utah. If they win Friday night, I think Utah's sitting there hoping that LSU beats, Georgia. And I think pole position in my mind would be Utah to go into that fourth spot. And I think if you're an Oklahoma fan, you want Oregon to knock off Utah on Friday night. And then I think, if LSU beats Georgia, this is the crazy part, the Big 12 championship game, winner will be the last team standing. So it's obvious about Oklahoma, but I think Baylor also, if they were to upset Oklahoma, Baylor, that's what we brought up earlier, they could be that team to slide in as the last team standing for that fourth spot. So I think Oklahoma needs help personally. Might be dead wrong, but that's the way I see it. I think a lot of people think Oklahoma is the team to beat, but I think Utah is.
This really comes down to how the committee views the Big 12 versus the Pac-12 when it comes to opponents, right? Because when you look, if we talk about everybody winning out, and that means Oklahoma winning out, maybe Baylor, they've got two wins against Baylor. And then that win against Oklahoma State, Texas, Iowa State. Now, how do you view that team or those teams and that resume and that conference versus Utah's wins against, you know, Oregon, Washington, BYU, ASU, Cal, and Washington State, because it coincidentally, OU and Utah both have losses to 8-4 teams.
Right.
And that's Kansas State and USC. So it's just how they view the conferences,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's fair. But I also think it's how you look, right? I mean, we're looking at Clemson saying, who have they beaten? But how do they look when they play? Right? I mean, their defense, people aren't moving the ball on them. I mean, it's one thing to play a lousy schedule or an inferior opponent, and it's another thing where that team just has no chance of scoring and winning. And with Utah, I mean, you could pull out the game in Seattle. By the way, that's a really tough place to play. I don't know, they're not having a great year, but it's still a very tough place to play. But you could point out a game or two here and there, USC, Washington. But other than that, I mean, really high scoring offenses. Like when you knock the Pac-12, it's not about Washington State and their offense, right? It's not about ASU and their offense. I mean, these teams are scoring points out west, but when they play Utah, they're not. And so, yeah, you're right. It's, do they have more respect for the Big 12 or the Pac-12? Sure. But I also think it's how they've looked while they played whoever they're playing. And, again, what can you criticize about Utah other than they don't play a great schedule in the Pac-12. I don't know what else. I don't know what else you can say.
I mean, they have one bad Friday night.
Yeah, Friday
one
night.
One bad Friday night at the Coliseum.
Their quarterback's in the top five in the nation in passing efficiency, which is probably the new wrinkle this year for them. There used to be just defense, running the ball, quarterback just, hey, don't make a mistake. Let's win this game. Let's play, get the short field. Let's win with defense and special teams. They're not like that anymore. I mean, they got an offense now and they got a quarterback. And I just don't think people, they hear Utah and they think skiing, I guess. I don't know. They don't think much about Utah football. I don't think people who are talking about Utah have seen much of Utah. And it's not like I'm Mr. Utah. I just go by what I see. Yep. And what I see is a really good football team. That's all.
And that's an excellent point by you saying they haven't seen Utah. And they were in prime time this past weekend on ABC. And now they get they get their own night. I was not crazy about the Pac-12 having a Friday night game for the championship, especially during rush hour in Santa Clara. But they get their own night for the entire country to watch Utah stack up against an Oregon team that I think everybody talks about Justin Herbert and Juwan Johnson, and that offense could score, but that's a good defense as well. So we could see them matched up. And I think the country can kind of say, all right, I'm not going to go with my norm thinking, hey, it's just Oklahoma. It's Oklahoma. It's Oklahoma. Cause years pass. Let me just judge this team by my eye test by watching Utah. And you know, that's one game. We've brought up Georgia. I do want to briefly, before we go into anything else, get your thoughts on the Georgia situation offensively against LSU, because they got no George Pickens in that first half because of that idiotic move with the fight, right? Oh. With Trey Swilling of Georgia Tech. DeAndre Swift's shoulder injury. He's been dealing with shoulder contusions all season. Looks like he's going to give it a go and he'll play. No word, but he's dealt with this injury all season and he could have come back. Yeah, I mean, Kirby said he could have came back in that game against Georgia Tech. And then they have no Lawrence Cager. So when you look at this Georgia offense, can they keep this a game against LSU? When I say scoring back and forth with whatever, you know, the Tigers are going to do with Joe Burrow.
Well, first, anytime you have a quarterback who's been in the battle as many times as Jake Fromm has, you always have a chance. I mean, with the defense that they have, which everybody, you talk about the mayhem moment, LSU and Joe Burrow's offense against that defense from Georgia, that is, man, that is must-see TV right there. I can't wait to watch that. I mean, that's going to be awesome. So you got a great defense and you got Jake Fromm and you got DeAndre Swift, even though he's banged up, who's more than capable, right? And you got an LSU defense, as I talked about last week, going to show up in a bad mood against A&M. They're being told by the committee that Ohio State's more complete. It's another way of saying the LSU defense isn't very good. And they took that personally and they got Grant Delpit back healthy. And I thought they put their best foot forward. So they're playing with more confidence. And I think they're more capable than the perception on the outside world about that defense. And I got a lot of confidence in Dave Aranda. So here comes LSU's defense. And what have we been saying about Georgia and their offense all year? We've been talking about where is the vertical passing game? Taking pressure off of DeAndre Swift and this offensive line in the running game. Think of the receivers they had the last couple years and the playmakers and Godwin and Hardman and Ridley. Where are they? And then Cager started to develop a little bit, right? And occasionally we'd see the freshman Pickens make a play and we're like, oh, okay, they're developing a little something here. They got a couple guys that can help in this area for Fromm. Cager's got an ankle, not playing. Pickens decided to be an individual, not think about the team, let his emotions get the best of him, looked like an idiot. And he ends up getting in a fight. He's out the first half. I mean, that is – now who do you have? I mean, you're looking at Blaylock, Robertson, Wolf, the tight end, Simmons. So can they win the game? Of course they can win the game. They're only a 7-point underdog, and the defense and Fromm and Swift can give them a chance to win the game. Not to mention that dome in Atlanta, it's probably going to be as good as LSU's fan base is. They only get a certain amount of tickets. All the local seats, got to think a lot of Georgia fans. It's going to be 60-40, maybe 70-30. It's almost going to feel like a home game for Georgia. So you got an underdog mentality. You're playing for your life. You're playing for your right to prove everybody wrong and get into the playoff and win the SEC. And you're doubted. You're questioned. How are they going to do this? How are they going to do it? How do you stop Joe Burrow? So a lot of things from the psychological approach to the game, give Georgia definitely a chance to win this game. At the end of the day, they got to stop Joe Burrow and Clyde Edwards-Helaire and those great receivers, Jamar Chase, Justin Jefferson. It's going to be a challenge for them. But I think the mindset of Georgia gives them a great chance to be competitive in this game.
All right, Herbie, so as we get ready for championship weekend, the one thing that kind of bugs me, and I always flirt with the idea of a playoff where I love four, but I would love six or even eight, was if LSU and Ohio State were to lose, they're still in the playoff conversation. They're still, they drop maybe, but they're still in the top four. I wish they made this a quarterfinal weekend. And if you expand it to eight teams and you include the AP poll, because we don't have the playoff ranking poll right now, the highest seeds would get to host. Looking at the recent AP poll, it would feature LSU versus Baylor, Ohio State versus Florida, Clemson versus Oklahoma, Georgia versus Utah. What do you think of, you know, this hypothetical, if we made this weekend a quarterfinal weekend and still had obviously the pageantry of the bowls, and then later on you get the bowl games featuring the playoffs semifinals?
It's a delicate subject. I think when they first went from the BCS, which was just two to four, I was fired up. I thought this is great. You know, that this is a chance to give a couple more teams a chance to get in. And I think if the conference commissioners are being honest with themselves, I think after we've watched this model since 14, what I feel like it's done is it's created this. The only thing that matters is who's in. You know, we have guys now skipping bowl games because they're quote unquote irrelevant scrimmages. And you're talking about games like Sugar Bowls and Rose Bowls and Orange Bowls. I mean, what? What? I mean, these are games, if they're not in the rotation of being one of the semifinals, you know, you have players, we have a generation of players now that are growing up being told by people, you know, not to play in these games. You never heard that in the BCS era. And so I think what we've done is we've made the playoff with four so big that it's made a Notre Dame, who, what'd they finish, 10-2, feel like their season's irrelevant. We just talked Auburn earlier, 9-3. With the schedule that they played, that Auburn team by their fan base should be celebrated for years for what they did in 2019. But there's kind of a, but we're not going to the playoff kind of feeling. And I hate that. And so I think after all that I've seen, I would never have said I would want to see it go to six or go to eight. But now I am. Now I definitely would be. I would love to see it opened up. I do not want to see conference champions automatically go into a playoff. I still want the idea of the best teams. I don't want to just pat somebody on the head, even though there's two or three teams that are better in this league over here, that you go automatically because you're a champion. I wouldn't be personally a fan of that. I still think you referenced the AP, whatever rankings you want to use. I would still use the top six or top eight would be the teams that would go in. The reality is everybody needs to take a step back and look at we have the best regular season model in sports. There's nothing better than college football from early September to right now, right? I mean, every week we get excited about different matchups and the magnitude of them. And then we get to the postseason. It's like we hit the brakes and we've got weeks off, and you know, you watch some of these bowl games, we don't have big crowds, and there's a perception from fringe college football fans that they kind of just, you know, what's the big deal? It's postseason. Yeah. Whatever. Who's playing? Like they don't seem to follow it with the same energy that they do in the regular season. So I don't know what the answer is, but I do think expanding it would be a good thing. The only challenge you have is the SEC championship game, which is the only one that has history, the only one that every year, doesn't matter who's in the game, stadium is busting at the seams, big ratings, big excitement. They're the only ones that have that. How are you going to replace that? You know, you have to figure out a way to make sure the SEC is okay, because you couldn't still have conference championship games like we have now, right? You'd have to take those away. So you'd have to have different ways of being able to make sure that the SEC, would they ever agree to not playing in an SEC championship. I mean, for their fans, that's as big a deal, maybe bigger than the playoff. Mm-hmm. You know, getting to Atlanta and playing in that game, it's a big deal. So would the SEC ever agree to it? And if they would, I think you'd have to respect the fact that, you know, you have to compensate the SEC for that, because that's a huge weekend for them.
I'm just happy that you're on board with my idea of an 8-team playoff.
Yeah.
Because and I think this weekend would have been so exciting, right?
Yeah, and I think, you do the home game deal with the higher seed, and then you got to hold on to the Bulls. You know, I think there's something still great about – you get about – after Christmas, you get into December 28, 29, 30, these bowl games. People can poo-poo the Bulls all they want. You're uninformed. I'm telling you. Talk to players that go to bowl games. These players love going to bowl games because you know what? As a college athlete, you have no freedom and you get to go to a bowl game. You get to hang with some of your buddies. You get to go, you know, around town, wherever you might be and hang out a little bit and have a little bit of freedom. And you're in a cool city. Bowls are a huge thing for players. They love them. Don't let fans and social media tell you they don't. Now, I think there's, again, perception when you watch these games, December 22, 23, when there's not a lot of people in the game or at the game, that people kind of roll their eyes about bowls. But, I feel bad for people that think that the bowls are not a big deal. They are a huge deal. That's why if you ever did expand, you'd have to hold on, to those bowls after you did the 8 with the home field. The next round, of course, you can incorporate the bigger bowls all the way out to you eventually crown a champion.
And my argument to anybody that says that no one cares about the bowls, look at the ratings.
Oh,
people
yeah.
genuinely care about these bowl games.
Yeah.
The ratings are ridiculous in between because we love football. In between that December 21st, the December 28th, that string of game, like that week where you have those games jam packed, the numbers are fantastic across the board.
Yeah. And I think the players, a lot of times people think that because a couple players skip bowl games, that the players don't like the bowl games.
It's just not
accurate. The players, again, what they love is being able to go hang with their buddies, in Orlando or Tampa or Nashville or Miami or wherever they go, because they practice in the morning and then, hey, fellas, you have the rest of the day off, you know, curfews at whatever time. And you're free. It's like, what? This is great. You know, you go get something to eat and you hang out and you do whatever you're going to do. And you're in a cool town. So yeah, they are a big success and a big part of the tradition and the fabric of the sport.
Final question before we wrap things up. We covered a lot of topics and we'll get to Twitter questions, next Monday when we have you on, from our great loyal fan base. I do want to get your thoughts on some of the quick stories, news stories off the field, transfers and coaching changes. We've seen that a lot in the last 48 hours. Jake Bentley of South Carolina, Felipe Franks from Florida. Both of them saying they're transferring. Franks could test the NFL. Some of the coaching changes, Matt Luke out at Ole Miss, Adazio out at BC, Barry Odom out at Missouri, Charlie Strong out at USF, Tom Herman, Herm Edwards already making coordinator changes with their staffs respectively at Texas and Arizona State. Anything that stands out from what I've just mentioned or even the conversation that it seems like we've heard a back and forth about Clay Helton. He's out. No, he's not. He's still around. We don't know as we're taping this podcast on Monday.
Right. That's the one I was going to bring up. Like, I heard the news yesterday, you know, on my phone, you know, I get these updates and it says Clay Helton's been let go. And I was like, oh man, they did it. You know, I picked up my phone. I texted Clay like, hey, sorry to hear about that. You know, you're a great coach and look forward to your next step, you know, and then like a couple hours later, no, wait, he's not. And I'm like, oh man, I feel like an idiot. So I texted him back. Oh my God, I'm sorry. So I can't keep score of that one. And they've been trying to fire him for forever. So, I guess we'll wait to see what the news is with that decision for SC. I think the quarterbacks deciding to leave, it's part of the world that we live in. There are going to be a lot more. portal names that will surface, whether it's quarterbacks or anybody else. And instead of fighting that and kind of stomping the ground and jumping up and down, well, this makes no sense. I just think you have to just realize this is where we are. This is 2019. Guys are going to leave for different reasons. And I think coaches and programs have to realize that that's kind of like, it's just like guys leave early for the NFL. Like now you have guys that are going to leave in the transfer portal and guys are going to come in the transfer portal. So I think, when I first started hearing this a couple of years ago, I was like, what in the heck? You're committed to your school and what are you doing? You know, and I still feel like you can learn a lot through adversity and a lot through things not going your way and, not giving a player an automatic or an easy out. But at the same time, if it's the new rules, if you've graduated, you've earned the right to be able to leave and you have eligibility, then a lot of these guys are going to make a decision to go for whatever reason. So it is what it is as far as that's concerned. The coaching changes, you know, we've got what, Ole Miss, we've got Boston College, Rutgers has now been filled with Greg Schiano, Arkansas. There's a few that have opened up. It seems like every other year it's a big number. Right. And this isn't a year necessarily where I think you're going to see a lot of jobs open up, but it'll be interesting to see who gets the opportunity. If it's some of the hot coordinators or if it's, you know, a guy that's an established coach at a lower level that's looking to kind of move up. But yeah, this is just the beginning of it all though, really, Kevin, as you know, with players and coaches, being on the move.
And you mentioned one guy, and I know you're high on him, and I'm high on him as well, from the American. That's Mike Norvell. We could see his name in a bunch of openings as Memphis, of course, gets ready for Cincinnati, the American Championship. You're getting ready for the Pac-12 Championship, Herbie, on Friday night on ABC and then Saturday in Atlanta for game day. Appreciate it, man. We covered a lot of topics today, but this is what I love. We wrapped up the regular season. We get ready for now the playoff and the postseason.
And then we get to talk Tuesday. Next week, right? We get So next week, the rankings aren't like, well, we'll see what happens on Tuesday. Next week, the rankings, as you know, are Sunday, done deal. Teams will be set. Bowl games will be set. You and I, we'll have to go 2 hours next week because we'll have so much to, we'll have so much to get into. It'll be fun next week.
I'm down with that because our Heisman conversation will be a minute long. Joe Burrow, who else gets invited?
That's about it. Will Chase Young get an invite? I mean, what else do you have for me? Because Joe Burrow, that thing seems to be a wrap. That's for sure.
Herbie, appreciate it, buddy. Talk to you soon.
All right, man. Have a good one.
Want to remind you guys, if you have a question for Herbie or Pollock, go to Twitter, hashtag CFB pod, ask away. Best questions make the podcast, which Taylor sorts out. We had a handful of them waiting, but there were so many topics today to cover. And trust me, in the coming weeks, we will have plenty of time to dive into the questions for Herbie. Want to thank him for joining us to get his thoughts on the biggest storylines from the weekend. Also moving forward, the biggest storylines heading into Tuesday night in the playoff rankings. Want to thank our sponsors, AT&T and Allstate. As usual, don't forget, you've got to check out ESPN Daily on Monday's edition. Mina Kimes looks at the Patriots' loss to the Texans and asks this question. Did that game finally prove Tom Brady has slipped? I'm not asking that. They're asking that. Plus, does anyone want to win the NFC East? I will answer that for you. No, no one wants to win the NFC East. Mina and her group will have much more on that on ESPN Daily. Big thanks to our producer, Taylor Schwenk, who always does a great job on the other side. If you enjoyed this podcast and you want more, all you have to do is subscribe to the College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. And, of course, remember to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. Cannot wait to have the conversation on Wednesday with Pollock, as well as Heather Dinich and Ivan Mazel, breaking down what we heard from the committee on Tuesday night. Till then, enjoy.